Yeah, today is the 30th of July, 1981, and this is an interview with Air Marshal Dunlap, a continuation of the Dunlap saga. It's an interview by Dr. Roy at the University of Victoria. Now, it seems to me, Larry, we left off, you were up in scooting around northern France and Belgium and looking for a landing, or at least a new site for your 139 squadron.
That's right. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Now, presumably you found a... Yes, you did.
We found it, yeah. I'll pick it up from there.
All right, fine.
But there's one thing I want to mention before we get on to that. We spoke about Dunsfold and the fact that the Royal Canadian Engineers had built it and that it was the only field, airfield, built in the UK by the engineers. They built fields, of course, over in the operational theater in Normandy and so on, and up through right into Holland. But it wasn't their task or job to build in the UK. That was the job of the Department of Works and the Air Ministry and so on. But you recall that Andy McNaughton needed, and the RCF needed, field in a new location because the old Sarum field used by the Army Cooperation Wing or squadrons was no longer suitable in location for the Canadian Army, and Andy and Gus Edwards, I think, went to Air Ministry and said we need a new field in a new location closer to our Canadian troops. The Air Ministry was sympathetic to this, of course, and said, well, sure, we'll provide you with one. It'll take from 18 to 20 months to do it, of course. And Andy threw his hands up in the air and said, that's no good to me. I want it in 18 to 20 weeks. Mm. And they, of course, said that was impossible. He said, well, if you'll give me the authority to use the Royal Canadian Engineers, I'll build it in that length of time. And they did, and he did. But and I gave you the details of that earlier, but I just ran across this passage in the history of the Royal Canadian Engineers. It's very brief, and it'll substantiate what I said. And this I quote from here. The 2nd Battalion moved to Dunsfold on the 13th of May, 1942, to construct a bomber field. It was the 2nd Battalion RCE. Attached, which was assigned to the Canadian Army troops because the Air Ministry and Department of Works contractors could not do the job by the date required by the RCAF. On 19th of May, the battalion was joined by the 2nd, a road construction company, with the whole operating under Lieutenant Colonel D.H. Storms and Major H.D. Duff. From the 6th Construction Company, was assigned to the job as construction developers. Progress was good, although the weather was bad throughout the greater part of the job. In general, the 2nd Battalion was responsible for the runways, drainage, and clearing, while the 2nd Road Construction Company laid the perimeter tracks and the dispersal areas. Buildings were left to civilian contract. The first concrete was poured on the 27th of May. You know, that's just 2 weeks after they arrived there. On the 20th of June, the first plane landed, a light one, and the runways and the perimeter track were completed by the 15th of August, 2 weeks ahead of the deadline. Now, that's quite a job.
Yeah.
Now, there was one other thing that you asked about, and that was Canadians in 139 Wing. You recall 139 Wing was a Royal Air Force wing.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't respond very fully to that, and I thought I'd just mention that my senior administrative officer was Canadian. I arranged for him to come there, Squadron Leader Dan McClan. He had been with me out in North Africa. He was one of the chaps I recovered who had been an alcoholic and I took him out there and where he couldn't get any alcohol, and he did an absolutely superb job, and for the rest of the war he was a winner. My senior flying control officer was Canadian, Sunday to Dutton. And he carried over from the days, you know, although I was commanding the thing in with the Royal Air Force Wing there, you recall that there had been a Canadian wing there previously because it was built for the Canadians. Mm-hmm. And therefore, the flying control officer had been a Canadian, so he just carried on. He was a first class fellow. My Adj was a Canadian. Now, again, because it had been a Canadian in Canadian command before, mm-hmm. Hank Burden was the previous CO, the brother-in-law of Billy Bishop, World War I fellow.
Oh, for him.
Great chap. And he had a Canadian Adj, and the Adj just remained on. But he had to go back. He was given compassionate leave to go back to Canada. His father was dying. So I expected to automatically receive a Royal Air Force Adj because all my personnel were RAF, and it would have been quite normal. I wouldn't insist on any Canadian Adj under those circumstances. But to my surprise, and slightly to my horror, I went into the mess one day. I saw a stranger at the bar with Canada badges on his shoulder. And I walked up and asked him who he was and introduced myself and asked what he was doing at Dunsfold. He said, "I'm your new adjutant, sir."
Oh, he can.
This was without consultation with me, and I presume without consultation with my RAF group headquarters. And I was annoyed about it. And furthermore, he was he looked and was acting like an alcoholic right from the word go. Yeah. And it proved that he was. He had been on Chubby Power's staff. He was one of Chubby Power's executive assistants at one time, and he got overseas. And because of the connection, I guess he got moved quite quickly into a Canadian outfit, and he wound up as my aide. So I could see that we were in for a little trouble if he were going to be carry on like this. Mm-hmm. I read the riot act to him right there the very first day and told him how quickly he was going to be back in Canada if he didn't shape up. Mm-hmm. And actually, he turned out to be a pretty useful character. He was an odd individual, but nonetheless, he was a he was intelligent, and he got on the job quickly and handled the RAF administrative procedures without any great difficulty. he was a pugilistic type of chap. He didn't stand for any nonsense, and I did run into a queer situation later on with him. After we went to the continent and were stationed over there at Melsbrook, I had a squadron leader communicator, signals officer, who was a rather an obnoxious type, Royal Air Force type. And he had a habit of goofing off a bit from his work. And McMillan took a very dim view of anybody doing that sort of thing. But one night at the bar, they...
McMillan is the Adj.
Yeah, my Adj.
Right.
McMillan, I think the signals chap had been a little critical of some personnel. And McMillan just turned right around on him and accused him of goofing off. And McMillan knew that he had gone off one or two days earlier and shacked up with a girl for when he should have been working.
Yeah.
So he let him have it right, you know, straight.
Mm-hmm.
And this fellow took a dim view, and he said to McMillan, "He's step outside and we'll settle this." And of course, McMillan wasn't far better. McMillan, because of my strictures, of course, had only had one. He was keeping his drinking very much under control. I think the squadron leader, his senior officer by far, was perhaps not as sober as he should have been. McMillan took one swing at him and knocked him cold. That's rather serious when a junior officer hits a senior officer, and no matter what the circumstances. So in my position, I had to take some action. So I appointed a rather carefully chosen RAF type to investigate this for me. And he came back with a report that nobody would give any evidence against McMillan Because they all just like this. And the squad leader. So finally, I was compelled to drop the charges. But you know, that had a pretty solitary effect. And Paul McMillan and I have had many laughs about that ever since. Of course, I had a number of... as was the case in almost, I guess, in every Royal Air Force squadron during the war, there were Canadian air crew. And, I'd like to mention just one. I had a fair number of them there in the wing, but one that would be of interest to you was a lad by the name of Adamson, who was in 180 Squadron. When I went there, he was a flight sergeant, pilot. Mm-hmm. Most of the air crew, quite a number of the air crew were commissioners, you know. Mm-hmm. But he was a pilot who wasn't commissioned. And
Canadian.
And he came up before me for a commission. And I recommended it. I thought he was a very promising type, and he'd had a good operational record up to that time. And very interestingly, he retired from the service 2 years ago, or three, as a lieutenant general, Dave Adamson. And he's living here in Victoria right now. I don't know whether you have met him or know that he's here. He's not here too frequently because he's the representative in the western part of the United States for de Havilland Aviation. Therefore, he's in the United States most of the time. His territory goes right out to Hawaii.
Yeah.
But he lives out here in Sydney.
That's my soul.
I thought I should mention, because you might want to get in touch with him sometime.
Yeah. There's another thing, too, Larry. I knew that in the Royal Air Force, there were quite a number of sergeant pilots.
Yeah.
But I didn't know that we had very many.
We did. Yes, we had a policy of commissioning only a certain proportion of pilots when they finished their training of the BCATP, a certain proportion of navigators and a certain proportion of wireless operator gunners, or straight air gunners.
Yeah. Mm.
And it was a descending proportion. I've forgotten what it was. Let's say 40% of the pilots were commissioned, 60% weren't. And then it scaled down. The navigators commissioned maybe almost the same number, but when you go down to the air gunner, it was perhaps 15% or 10% of them were commissioned and the others were NCO. Those proportions altered a bit as the war progressed.
Yeah.
But those were roughly the proportions in the early part of the war, and that would be the thing that applied when Adamson joined up.
Yeah. Was this based on a similar proportion in the Royal Air Force?
No, it had nothing to do with that. It was just something established in Canada. And the RAF had far more NCOs in there, amongst their crew, than we had. But when I took over that bomber base in 6th Group, when I first went overseas at the end of 42, the number of NCO air crew in my NCO's mess was huge. It swamped the old time NCOs, and they rather resented it. Here were these youngsters who were suddenly sergeants or flight sergeants or whatnot, with wings up of various descriptions, and here they had soldiered on for years, and they felt that their mess was being invaded and intruded by people who were wet behind the ears.
Yeah.
So it sometimes causes a little bit of... Well, there you are. I don't think I need to say anything more about that. I didn't make a point of trying to draw Canadians in there because of our... I should mention, perhaps I've avoided mentioning this, I did have an influence on having a Canadian who just came over from the BCATP come and join the wing. And a mutual friend of ours, mutual friend of this chap and mine, had arranged for us to meet in London. It was a social meeting, and when we met, this chap had just arrived from Canada. He'd had a remarkably fine record in the Commonwealth Air Training Plan, and he was a chap who had been a pilot pre-war, and he had an awful lot of flying experience. And based on his experience and upon his success at Bomber Command, he looked like a fairly good bet as a squadron commander, potential squadron commander. As soon as we met, And he learned about my operations in the tactical Air Force. He was right on to me to try to get him into second draft, and he sounded pretty keen and enthusiastic. And I said, well, I said I would take it up at my group headquarters. I explained to him that the fact it was a Royal Air Force formation made it a little difficult for me to do this. But if they felt that they wanted to give him a try, I'd give him a recommendation. So, in due course, he came. Well, he illustrated the fact, as it developed, that a success in the training organization in Canada is not necessarily success on operations overseas. Now, he did his job, mm-hmm. but from the moment I first took him up for a little flight on the Mitchell to give him some experience with it. Mm. You know, when you flew over there, the air, as you observed yourself the other day, the air must have been full of aircraft, mm-hmm. and so it was. Mm-hmm. And it was even more so because there were down that area where we were flying, there were so many prohibited areas. The defenses of London caused you to avoid flying over those,
yeah.
and they had balloon barrages all over the place, and you didn't want to fly in those areas anyway. That meant it pushed the rest of the flying down that southern part of England into a much smaller sector than ordinarily would have been the case. And that, combined with the fact that which generally always smoggy and murky from the industrial smog, mm-hmm. meant that it was a little bit frightening flying down there, I suppose. We got used to it, and we expected to see an aircraft suddenly appear on the port side coming towards you, and another one coming up from the left-hand side, and you just took a biz of action if it looked too serious.
Yeah. Whoops.
And I had him in the co-pilot seat. I was flying the aircraft on that first flight. I could see him sort of duck and cower a little bit every so often. And he was really terrified of these things. I thought to myself, this doesn't look very promising. And I did another one or two fights with him, and he didn't seem to adjust to Redley. And good God, how's he going to be in formation flying when he has an aircraft right on his wingtip? Well, he never did adjust quite correctly. I carried him through a brief operational tour, but he didn't have what my AOC required, and that was fire in his belly.
Yeah.
And Basil Embry wouldn't have anyone around who didn't have fire in his belly. And so... as I say, he did a very quick tour, because we were at that time operating generally twice a day. It didn't take very long to, and the shortest tour I could give him was 35 sorties. So.
Yeah.
I went through him very rapidly. That was one of my great mistakes in two group in my time 139 wing was, I had some doubts from the beginning,
yeah.
but. I should have stuck by my feelings, and sometimes you don't. And,
well, you know, thinking of that particular theme, when you consider that they trained in the vast open skies of Canada...
Not surprising.
Coming
not
over
surprising,
to
yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
And even flying in that murk is frightening. You see, he would have been accustomed to flying where you could see.
Yeah.
Where you could see the ground. Here we were flying where you could see damned all, generally.
Yeah.
And...
I never thought of that.
It could be a bit terrifying. Well,
yeah.
You can't win them all. And it was a little embarrassing for me to have a Canadian come in and not be absent, especially after the record of Rod Bell Irving, who had command of one of those squadrons just before.
Well,
let's go on to get back to where we were. I think I should mention that during September of 1944, you'll recall just where the Canadian troops and the Allied troops were at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Our targets naturally swung away from the Normandy area and were mainly, I guess towards the end of August and early in September, we were attacking targets that tended to be over in the Pas-de-Calais area and around Boulogne and Dunkirk and so on. We had a lot of operations against the gun positions in Dunkirk and in Boulogne and other targets as the troops moved up. And then we began operating into the Scheldt area. We had targets at Breskin and Flushing and Walcher and Beebe and those islands out there. And,
would can I interject here? Yeah. Would you have would your wing have anything to do with the breaking of the dams and all that sort of thing? And
we didn't. The only thing I can remember attacking was a causeway, which I presume was a part of the dam system. The causeway, I think it was, I'm not sure of this, but I think it was between Walchern and the adjacent island, Beveland, or one of those islands.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that was a part of the dam system, whether it was just a causeway carrying a highway and railway bridge, highway and railway traffic, I don't know, but...
Mm-hmm.
So I, and that's the only answer I can give you to that question. Then, of course, we, before very long, and still in September, were attacking targets way up in the Arnhem area. And that was making pretty long flights from Dunsfold down to southern England. Long flights for formation flying, you see.
Yeah.
And before very long, well, we had a number of targets, strong points in around Bartlett. Arnhem, and then we had a series of targets just over the border in Germany, just across the Dutch-German border, which were transportation type of targets, rail and road and bridge targets leading into the Arnhem area.
Mm-hmm.
All of which were stretching us. We were attacking places like Emmerich and Venlo, which was on the Dutch side, and Gawk and Cleve and Gurdon and that sort of thing.
That gives you an idea of the area.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good idea. Yeah, that's fine. Yeah. So, you can understand the urgency for our move from the south of England.
Yep.
And I had told you, I think, in our last talk, that on the 9th of September, we had done this sweep and survey of the possible locations for our bases over there. And in due course, that Melsbrook was selected as the base for my wing. I think that authority didn't come through until about the 20th of September. And from then onwards, it was still a busy operational period for us. Mm-hmm. We were doing all these operations I just talked about.
Mm-hmm.
I was on the go back and forth between Dunsfold and Melsbrook with great frequency. I think between, I guess I made my first flight over there about the last few days of September. And then from then on, through to the 8th or 9th of October, I must have made about 8 or 9 flights back and forth, arranging for the setting up of the facility. It was a very complex business because, I think I also mentioned Melsert was perhaps the largest airfield in Europe. Had been built by the Germans, using forced labor and so on, and it wasn't to be my field alone. I was sharing it with another wing, and I was sharing it with all these transport aircraft that were flying in supplies for the army, and I was also sharing it with a number of other special operators.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, on top of that, it was a hospital field for Forts and Libs. Crippled Forts and Libs landed at Melsbrook because it was such a big field they could have, there was lots of parking areas for them while they were being repaired. So it was it wasn't an easy move. The division an allocation of space was very complex.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the first things I had to do was, when I went in there on that first flight towards the end of September, I had to sit down with the group captain commanding the other Royal Air Force wing, operational wing there, and come to terms on what would be my sphere of influence on the field and what would be his, and what facilities he would have, what I would have, and the buildings, of course, were pretty badly wrecked.
Yeah.
But those that were not wrecked, he'd already occupied, so it made my position a little bit difficult. And
excuse me, Larry, these included not only the hangars, aerodromes, that sort of thing, but they would be living quarters.
Oh, living quarters, too, yeah. And the Germans had done themselves up proud. It was obviously, they expected this to be a German installation for years to come. It was going to be the new international airport for Brussels. And the previous one, which was adjacent, was far too small. And they built in a scale that was just unbelievable. The quality of the buildings. And A few of these buildings had escaped demolition or bombing. Not many. A few of the hangars had all been bombed.
Yeah.
Some of them were usable in part, but not a very big part. So he already had good captain, I've forgotten his name now. He had a mosaic, photographic mosaic of the field, and we used that as for drawing sort of a line, one side of which he would occupy, another side of which I would, and there had to be one or two overlaps.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't make it all black and white, there were one or two gray areas. But my operation required a good deal more space than his, because he was using mosquitoes, and they didn't require quite as much room and facility and as my machines. And so we came to an agreement. Obviously, he had the better part of it, because being there first. But I could see possibility that we could live with, and there were still a few places that the Germans had used for housing their troops that had not been utilized, and so I was able to arrange for those. And I left my goods administrative chap, McCann, there on that first flight. I left him there to follow up some of the things that we had all discussed and make sure that this RAF outfit lived up to the bargain and so on. So he labored away on this and arranged with the Belgian authorities for the use of some of the surrounding establishments like convents and whatnot for the billeting of the troops. Not really billeting, but for the housing of the troops.
Mm-hmm.
And for certain other large estates for officers' messes and quarters and so on. He was laboring away with that on that. And then I went back frequently with special officers while we were still continuing to operate intensively for Dunsfold. I would take my senior technical officer and signals officer and so on, all these special officers over, engineering officer, squadron commander, so on, to get them familiar with what was ahead of them and let them have a stay in their office and living accommodation.
Yeah.
So this took quite a number of trips. It was rather interesting, you know. I'd drive myself down to my aircraft in the morning, early. We generally took off about 7 o'clock over there. And I'd be driving on what we refer to as the wrong side of the road. And then I'd fly over and land at Millsbrook, and I had a standing arrangement over there that a car would be waiting for me at a such a place, such a time. And then the rest of the day I'd have to drive on the opposite side of the road. And then at nighttime I'd fly back, and my van would be waiting for me at my dispersal point, and I'd have to change back. And it was really quite quite an adjustment to make each day. Well, that gives you some idea of certain of the problems there in space allocation. Now, I think I told you that the Germans had done quite a good job at demolition after, on top of the attacks that the Allies had made on that. They had done a complete job of demolishing the runways. Not probably as an effective one as we had done ourselves when we were destroying those fields, and they were on one or two of those main runways were in absolute shocking condition. They had 4,000-pound bombs down through the pavement many places. That had an effect on the field, you know, on our operations, because I think I told you we started out having to operate on the grass while we were repairing, pouring concrete in the holes and everything like that. But then again, we had a very severe parking problem. If I were to sort of try to use parking spaces remotely over the field, I'd never get my wing assembled for a formation takeoff or for a rapid takeoff, because of the congestion on the field and all these construction vehicles trying to fill up holes. There are vehicles everywhere, and there are all these vehicles taking food and supplies away to the army. So I had to take the decision to park my aircraft wingtip to wingtip on an unused portion of a destroyed runway. It was one of those runways that was about one-third usable. The rest was bunged up. So here, when my aircraft came in from a raid, they just lined up wingtip to wingtip. They're very vulnerable. I mention this because it has a bearing later on. And when they, we had to bomb them up as soon as they got in, you know, food, refuel them and bomb them, yeah. Get ready for the next operation. So they were not only wingtip to wingtip, but they were bombed up wingtip to wingtip. It's a good indication of the degree of air superiority we had by that time. We weren't afraid of what the Germans could do. We were prepared to take the chance. If we got caught, it would have been worth it for this ease of operations and so on. So, well, I'm getting a little bit mad myself. Ellsbrook, I should tell you a little bit about it. The Germans had been clever in the way they developed that field. They had dispersal sites scattered all over the countryside adjacent to the field, with taxiways leading into them. And the buildings that served as servicing centers for the aircraft out in these far and distant points were all built in conformity with the architecture of the countryside. So the servicing hangar would look like a farmhouse or a farm barn or a schoolhouse, and they would copy them exactly. So that they'd have a little, and they would preserve little clusters of trees around nearby to make it all look like the farmland. Even the administrative buildings were built to not to look like anything administrative, and the messes and the quarters were built to conform to the Belgian style, so that it looked as though they were just tucked away in a normal peacetime development. So it was something to behold.
Yeah.
And as I say, all built by forced labor. It didn't cost the Germans very much to do all this. But it was well done. Fortunately, they didn't demolish everything. And one of the buildings that remained reasonably intact was the main administrative building with the flying control tower on it. There had been bomber squadrons. It was the biggest bomber base of the German forces in Western Europe. And it had big briefing rooms to brief the aircrew. It had big intelligence and operations staff rooms where all the intelligence material was kept in the office. And of course, the offices of the senior staff are all in there. The base commander had his office right in strategic position below the control tower. When we arrived, there were still bombs in all the corridors, and obviously they had wired those up, but the demolition had been a failure. You know, you'd have staff trying to get out the secret papers and running around all the time the demolition crew was wiring up with those fine small wires, one bomb to the next, and probably one staff would kick the wire and break the connection and so on. And in the pandemonium of evacuating the base, it could easily happen that the demolition would not be successful, and that's what happened in this building. It had obviously failed. So that when we got in there, although there was the damage to the building was mainly damage that the Allies had done before we occupied, but the Germans had done some of their own. They just stripped the wires up in the control tower. They just pulled things off the wall and panels and everything. I had broken all the wires. That meant that we couldn't make use for a while of any of the fine control facilities, but very soon we got that in the back of the shape. Another feature of interest, I told you that the old international airport for Brussels was nearby. It was a field called Evere, and Evere was about 2.5 miles, or three perhaps, closer to the city of Brussels than Malmesbrück. And the Germans had put a winding country taxiway right across country, winding around the court contours between those two fields, so that if one field got unserviceable, they could pop over to the other. If they wanted to disperse from one field, they could do it over to the other. And it was a connection that we really never made use of, but I think in their time, they probably found it quite valuable. And 126 wing Spitfires was over there. Bill McBrien was the was the CEO that way, you know, the son of Sir James McBrien, former mm-hmm. Chief of the General Staff, Canadian Army. And he was a close friend of mine, but you know, our operations were so different,
mm-hmm.
And we were both intensely involved.
Yeah.
I hardly saw him the whole time we were there. Here we were just 5 miles separated in the taxiway between the two places.
Yeah.
One reason, perhaps, that maybe I didn't make an effort, that I suspected, and I had it on pretty good authority, that the coal that had been allocated for my wing, coal was a precious commodity.
Yeah.
You're lucky to get any, but we had 75 tons of allocated, and it was purloined, and I think it wound up over there in 1-2-6 thing, because they were on site a week or so before we were.
Oh, yeah.
And with that taxi wave between the two airfields, you could see how easy it was. You didn't have to go through checkpoints or anything.
Yeah. I appreciate. Beautiful.
Well, I think I also mentioned that I happened to be the senior commander on that field, senior group captain, and it therefore fell my lot, in addition to my operating my own wing operationally, to be responsible for all of the activities on the field, all the flying and all the maintenance, all the repair and all the filling up of the holes and runways. So it wasn't quite the neat, straightforward operation I had been used to at Dunsfold.
Yeah, I should say that.
When did your
own squadrons, at what time were they operational?
That's a good question. On the 10th of October, we made the move from Dunsfold to Brussels.
Mm-hmm.
And we operated at Dunsfold right up to that time.
Mm-hmm.
Practically right up to that time. And then we made the shift over there. I think they operated one day and landed back in
Brussels.
So that there wasn't really very much time lost. There was a stand down for a brief time because our servicing equipment had to get over there, but there was certainly servicing you could do without all that stuff.
So
we weren't out of action very long. When they arrived over there, well, I guess it was some time before that, I perceived that my opposite number, this chap I'd been negotiating with for space,
mm-hmm.
hadn't abided strictly by the agreement we'd entered into. And there was nothing left to chance on our agreement. We put it down in black and white, what he was to have, what I was to have. So when I arrived and found that he had commandeered one of the chaps at one of the spaces that was most important to me for servicing. The servicing had to be done outdoors, and it had to be on really reasonably good hard surface area. If you weren't going to have a hangar, you needed something under your feet there, because that was a wet time of the year.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, the aircraft would have sunk into the ground. I got there, and I found he had a tented encampment on this tarmac area, driven in steel spikes and down tents. And it was a convenient place for some of his line servicing personnel when they were near their aircraft and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "No, that's not in accordance with what we agreed." And he said, "Well, I admit that." He said, "These chaps got in there and got that done before I realized it." And he was playing on my feelings
mm-hmm.
and so on. You know, I can't really disturb them now.
Mm-hmm.
I said, "Well, I know how you feel, but..." and I laid it on, and finally, this went back and forth for 24 hours, I guess. Finally, I stuck by my guns, and he had to move. And of course, the troops were very annoyed about having to move. They'd gone to hell with a lot of effort to get those tents up. Not easy to put tents up on tarmac, you know. So we moved them out, and then we moved out just before my wing went in. There wasn't any need to move them until I moved over there. And by God, it was a damn good thing we forced that issue, because I hadn't been there more than 2 or 3 days when the first V1, we thought we'd seen the end of V1s, but the Germans got the damn things cranked up again, and they started firing V1s against Brussels and Antwerp, and V2s also against Antwerp. I don't think the second, can't recall any V2s against Brussels. And the very first day they fired these things, there weren't too many fired against Brussels. The very first day, the first one count to come over landed on Nellisbrook. And it landed smack in the center of this area where those troops had been. And they'd just been forced to move out of there 2 days earlier. So it was very fortuitous. I had some damage to the odd aircraft, and that was far better than having damage to RAF personnel. From that point onwards, our relations with the RAF wing improved, because everybody felt, well, maybe that chap wasn't so bad after all, forcing us to get the hell off the ground. While we're on the V1s, the first my facilities for an airfield mess, and you had to have some place for people to eat on the airfield, and for an officer's mess, were very, very meager. Each of the squadrons formed their own messes off field, because they were down near the little chateaus that or houses we were able to get from them. But the wing headquarters had to have some little facility on the field, and the building that was available had pretty severely damaged, and it was built in the style of the country, with those tile roofs, tile shingles, sort of like the half round tile.
That's right.
Rather attractive. But of course, every time a bomb went off and a vacuum was created, those damn things were lifted up and strewn around the countryside. Well, it took us quite a while to get together the material and get that repaired. The chaps worked. I had a lot of my own personnel working on that. They worked hard for quite a number of days getting that roof redone. Mm. And finally, the day came, and we were sort of toasting the fact that we'd got a place. It was raining pitchforks most of the time over there in Brussels, anyway. We got a roof over our head. Well, by God, the second day of the V1 attacks against Brussels, we heard it was early in the morning. It was raining. And I stepped out after breakfast with McCann and another chap. And we no sooner got out of the building than I heard this aircraft flying low overhead. And it was one of those days when it wasn't fit for flying at all.
Yeah.
The airfield was closed. It was so bad. And I said to McCann, for God's sake, who the hell is flying over here? And all of a sudden, the beat of the engine got through to me. And at that instant, the engine stalled, of course, and the message was driven home, and it was stopped right over our head.
Yeah.
Couldn't see it because of the weather conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And we flopped down onto this wet road, down on the gutter, to get a little bit of protection. And sure enough, the thing went bang just a few hundred yards beyond the building that we were using as a mess. And the explosion created the vacuum, and it lifted off all the shingles that we... or tiles that we'd got on there, and more. So we had to go through that whole thing. Well, those are the things you expect.
Yeah, the joys.
The wartime, the joys of war. Well, let me see. I don't think I'll tell you anything more about Nellisbrook. I should mention that, we worked assiduously on trying to repair the main runway.
Mm-hmm.
But some of those 4,000 pounders had gone down so deeply, they must have had a delayed fuse in some of them, that the crater was enormous and deep. And there was sort of a shifting mud down there. It was like a quicksand or a quick mud. And you could pour rubble in there, and it just seemed to devour it. There was plenty of rubble around, and we had arrangements with the Belgian authorities to keep these rubble trucks coming in there and pouring in there. God, we'd pour stuff in there, and it would just sort of flow. Well, there would be, the craters were so close to one another, I suppose that the ground was all soft in between, and it would just go in between them. And finally, I had to give up. I never succeeded in getting that number one runway fixed. We provided ourselves with a little additional parking space because we gained certain ground.
Yeah.
But I got into an area of extensive damage and extensive damage, and I was defeated on that. But we did get, of course, rather quickly got all the other runways back in mm-hmm. use, so we could get along without that main runway. Now, I'm going to tell you, you may wonder why I spend time on this, because, but I find it interesting. The Germans had some elementary devices there in an age of sort of complex technology, and it's worth mentioning. You know, we were bordering the time when there were special aids for lining up on runways and things like that. Early part of the war, you didn't have anything like that, but we were bordering on the time when there were facilities to beams and one thing or another that could be used for getting lined up in poor visibility. Mm-hmm. Well, Melsbrook didn't have any of those. Maybe the Germans had and then removed them, but I don't know. And we didn't have. But there was one thing that they left that intrigued me. And, of course, it's only an occupying power, I guess, that could do this sort of thing. They had a... let's take the main runway. Let's take the... take any runway. Starting out from the... from the ends of the runway, they plowed right cross country, a furrow with a plow, and they took it. It went straight out for maybe 1,000 yards,
mm-hmm.
or 500 or 600 yards anyway. So then it started to curve across country, and the rate of curvature was designed to conform to the average rate of curvature of an aircraft on its approach to landing on either end of the runway. And having done that, I guess it was pretty carefully plotted out and surveyed.
Yeah.
Then they added another 5 or 6, or even perhaps 10, parallel furrows, quite close, side by side,
yeah.
so that it made a fairly good-sized swath,
mm-hmm.
maybe a dozen. And then they just brought whitewash along, and they filled all those with whitewash, so that you had this white line on the ground leading up to the runways. And it, straight to start with, and then curving. And it showed up pretty well from the air when the visibility was bad. Now, you see, you may not appreciate this, but when you're looking forward from an aircraft,
mm.
out the front windows, you're looking at a fairly a small angle
mm-hmm.
Because you've got to look over the nose of your aircraft.
You can, mm.
And by the time you've got a clear view over the nose, you're looking fairly far forward, and therefore to see the ground forward, you need quite a lot of visibility. But if you're looking out your side window when you're in a bank turn,
yeah.
you're looking straight down the ground, and if you're doing your turn at 1,000 feet, or if you have to do it even down at 500, 600, or 400 feet, you can get over that, adjacent to that line, or over it,
mm-hmm.
and in your turn. And you can follow that thing. You're looking straight at your side. When you can open the side.